I'll be talking for the next little bit about mental health courts, and I want to recognize my co-author here, Stacy, who's my research associate at the University of North Carolina. She makes it all happen. Lots of acknowledgments. This study was supported by an R34 grant from NIMH. We've got a big research team that work together. Joe Morrissey, many of you may know him. He's retired now. Stacy, as I said, Brad Gaines, who's a psychiatrist at UNC, Eric Elbogen, Shenyang Guo, Worth Bolton, who's a motivational interviewing expert, Steve Martino, who's at Yale in the VA, Hank Stedman, everybody knows Hank, and Virginia Hyde. Also, I want to recognize the local mental health court team. They're called the Community Resource Court. Mental health would be too stigmatizing to use in the title, so they're labeled themselves Community Resource Court. It's been around for about 12 years now. I'll talk more about the court in a little bit, but Judge Joe Buckner, anytime you want to start a mental health court, you really need a local champion, and that local champion has to be a judge. So single-handedly, Joe started this mental health court. There's five in the state now. Marie Lamoureux, who's a court administrator, and Caroline Ginley and Jim White, who are mental health court staff. Unfortunately, like my colleague Greg, I have no financial conflicts to report. I'm sure you've heard that joke over and over again. All right, here's our agenda for today. Does anybody have a hidden agenda? Nobody, just a couple. All right, I'll try to be entertaining. Persons with severe mental illness in the criminal justice system, I'll talk a little bit about mental health courts. Then I'll talk about the rationale for the study. I'll talk a little bit about the community resource court. I'll talk about the intervention that was added to the court. This is dual diagnosis, motivational interviewing. I'll talk about the study phases and lessons learned. I've got some outcomes, but I'm finalizing data collection, and I'll talk more about that as we go. Lessons learned and then questions and answers. All right, so daily number of persons with mental illness in the criminal justice system at any given time. Over a quarter of a million folks with severe mental illness in the prisons, 130,000 in the jails, and 1.3 million in probation and parole arrangements. I have the circle around the jails because that number is probably closer to a million. Jails are short stay, quick turnaround facilities where folks with SMI are really cycling in and out. So most of our research has really been, at least mental health services research, have been focused on prisons and jails, and now there's a growing effort on specialty mental health probation and probation responses to folks with severe mental illness. But these numbers can be juxtaposed with, on any given day, 54,000 folks in our large state hospitals across the country. So it's quite a remarkable comparison. All right, rapid diffusion of mental health courts. There's lots of specialty courts now. Veterans courts have been the latest iteration. Drug courts, of course, have been around for 25 years or longer. Truancy courts, child welfare courts, you name it, there's a specialty court for it. Mental health courts are characterized by a specialized mental health docket. This is where folks with mental illness appear on the same docket on the same day. Judicially supervised community-based treatment plan, regular status review, and there's explicit graduation criteria. This comes from Council of State Governments and Fred Osher's group. Also, the evidence for, hey, Roger, I cited you, partner. You're right there, I cited you. Evidence for mental health courts are promising. They do improve treatment access and reduce recidivism. A bunch of folks have found that. Graduation rates are generally low, about 30 to 50%. And substance abuse, at least in one study, is connected with bad court outcomes. So judicial interventions are necessary, but maybe not sufficient to kind of maximize the effectiveness of these courts. And feel free to interrupt me as I go if anyone's got questions or points of clarification. Anybody so far? Good. All right. Fair enough. All right. So here is the RFA that was out. So the idea here, and it's not rocket science, is to add an intervention, in this case dual diagnosis motivational interviewing, to a local mental health court. Really, this was a feasibility study, our 34 three-year pilot. So the two primary aims was just establishing the feasibility of implementing an RCT in a mental health court. So that's aim one. Secondary aim, or a sub-aim to that primary aim, is it feasible that a mental health court clinician can be trained up to use the intervention in a court setting? Okay, and then there were some secondary aims. To what extent does DDMI improve behavioral health and criminal justice outcomes? It'll be underpowered, of course. This was a small pilot study. The rationale here, though, addressing substance abuse, trying to improve engagement, address service deficits, as we all know, the variability of community-based mental health services is pretty wide. These folks are often left with a mandate to go out and get services, but the quality of services, again, a lot of variability. Also, there's long waiting times. So the general idea here was let's give the court some kind of clinical intervention to give these folks a fighting chance while they're waiting to get connected with community-based mental health services. And one other thing about mental health courts, typically they're service brokers rather than service providers. So they do not provide direct services. Here's an attempt to add a direct service, a clinical service, albeit a brief clinical service, to a mental health court setting. Looks good on paper, at least, right? All right. So the Community Resource Court's been around since 2001. It operates in two counties in North Carolina. Orange is where UNC Chapel Hill is. Chatham is a large rural county, one of the biggest counties in the state. Serves about 100 folks annually. There's a mental health docket, a staffing prior to the docket where the judge, the lawyers, treatment team, sometimes providers, sometimes probation sit around and staff each case. They determine whether an offender is compliant, they determine whether an offender will have sanctions, and so forth. Basically, the treatment team tells the judge what to say to the offender when that offender appears before the judge. So, judge, tell this offender he or she is doing a good job, or judge, tell the offender if there's not a good report to bring his or her toothbrush to court because they'll be getting IBT, which is iron bar therapy. So typically the court lasts anywhere from 6 to 18 months. It's voluntary, so they do this in lieu of taking their chance in the criminal court. If you think about it though, sometimes it's a longer sentence than if they took their chances in the criminal court. Their charges could be dropped or they might have 2 weeks or time served versus could be up to 18 months with an assertive community treatment team. And to some consumers that might be harsher than a 2 week stay in jail. Thank you, Greg. Nonviolent misdemeanors, mostly with mental illness, with preference for severe and persistent mental illness. In Chapel Hill, we have SMI light. We don't have kind of the hardcore, or as many hardcore, chronic, homeless, severely, persistently mentally ill as we do in some of our larger urban areas, Washington, D.C., and New York City, and Chicago, and other places. So it's also, as I said, a service brokerage model. So here, just some outcomes from the court itself. If you look at their number screened, a steady decline over the study period, right around 60 to 65% male, three quarters white almost, average age around 33 or so. Typical months in CRC is a little over 8 there. And then graduation ranges, low of 38 to a high of 54 there. All right, so dual diagnosis motivational interviewing. This was modified by Steve Martino. And it's funny, I called up Steve. He didn't know me from Adam. And I said, hey, Steve, would you work with me on a proposal about motivational interviewing? And he said, I am so sick of working on proposals of motivational interviewing. So that was, I had a kind of a tall order there then to talk him into it. Ultimately, he did. He has worked over the last couple of years in modifying dual diagnosis motivational interviewing to accommodate both the psychiatric symptoms as well as the substance abuse. So really adhering to both at once. I further modified it to be used in a criminal justice setting. So now it has manualized treatment. It's got language that a mental health court clinician would say. And it incorporates also staying out of legal trouble as part of a three-legged stool of recovery, which I'll show you in just a second. Okay, so as I said, manualized for a mental health court setting. The end goal is really to develop a change plan. And then here's a couple tables. These are busy, but it goes over the adaptation for co-occurring disorders for psychiatric and substance abuse, but accommodating multiple behavioral targets, both staying compliant with psych treatment as well as reducing or cutting down on substance use, accommodating cognitive impairments, addressing positive symptoms and negative symptoms, and knowing when MI is appropriate and not appropriate to use. So basically giving guidelines for the mental health court clinicians. And as I'll talk about later, this has applications for other criminal justice settings as well. All right. And then further adaptations for criminal justice settings, kind of the highlights here, exploring the interface or the interaction of mental illness and substance abuse in involvement with criminal justice system. So how did substance abuse and mental health combine to put you in a position where you had contact with the criminal justice system? The third row down, using a three-legged stool analogy to discuss recovery, is related to the interaction of mental health, substance use, and patterns of criminal activity. All right, and then using a change plan to set recovery goals in mental health. So here's one of the visuals that the DDMI-trained mental health court clinician might use. Hey, Gary, do you mind if I talk to you a little bit about your substance use and how it might interact with your psychiatric diagnosis or mental illness? Do you mind if I share this information with you? Do you know that almost 70% of jail inmates with mental health problems were under the influence of alcohol or drugs at the time of their arrest? How do you feel about that? So that would be an exchange between the mental health court clinician and the mental health court participant. And those are real statistics. I didn't just make that up. All right, here's a change plan. You see this is a three-legged stool recovery where we're asking mental health court participants to make goals in each of these three areas. Quit or cut down on substance use. It's funny, but depending on the criminal justice application, cutting down is not an option. I'm using this in a study with probation, and they had me expunge the language of cutting down. They don't want any probationers cutting down. It's all or nothing. So, but making goals in substance abuse, participating in mental health treatment, and also identifying ways to stay out of legal trouble. So substance abuse being tied in one of those. Also avoiding situations or people, deviant peers, or environments where in the past the participant has become engaged with the criminal justice system. All right, so two phases to the R34. There was an open trial phase and an RCT phase. The open trial basically was just allowing the mental health court clinician to practice using the intervention. And we worked on the manual throughout this phase, fine-tuning it to the language of the mental health court. So we enrolled 21 individuals. I thought things were going to go great. It was relatively quick enrolling these 21, and then the wheels fell off. But 52% male, 43% white, 28% 43% mood disorders. And then the RCT. So basically, the design here was randomized to a DDMI intake with the DDMI-trained mental health court clinician, where she would fold in the use of motivational interviewing to the routine mental health court intake. So she'd start out with motivational interviewing, then provide some information about the expectations and requirements of the court, and then end again with the motivational interviewing to try to get to that change plan. So kind of like a DDMI sandwich. The standard intake was just the standard intake. This was delivered by another court clinician who is not trained to do any kind of motivational interview. And we took audio recordings of both and monitored Jack, where are you going? No, I'm joking. I'll return the favor, buddy. Oh, I'm so sorry, Jack. I have a bad habit of calling people out when I'm talking. All right, so 50 individuals participated. It took every scrap of study period and no cost extension to get these 50. It was just a difficult population to work with and enroll. I'll show you the statistics. I screened over 250 folks and ended up with 50. So that was the goal, really, to get that sample. But it took a long time. So folks who have done work with this population or in criminal justice settings like this, it is a struggle. So 50 individuals participated. There was a DDMI fused intake, baseline follow-up at 3, 6, and 9 months, a bunch of standardized measures in audio recording and fidelity scoring of the DDMI and standard intake sessions. Okay. So feasibility using DDMI, remember this was one of the primary questions, can we do an RCT and can we do DDMI in a court setting? And the answer to both of those questions is yes. So as you can see in the two phases, the open trial and the RCT phase, the use of DDMI and the feasibility, the acceptability improved. So during the first phase, the practice phase, the clinician was able to use DDMI 80% of the time. That shot up to almost 100 during the second phase, the RCT phase. We had an intake impression inventory that the mental health court clinician completed after each intake. So this is where these data come from. The consumer was engaged with DDMI during intake. This was a Likert, strongly agree, disagree, strongly disagree. So 61% of the time, strongly agreed or agreed in phase one, 80% in phase two. DDMI was effective, 40% in phase one and 72% in phase two. And then agreement to a change plan almost doubled from phase one to phase two. It didn't really lengthen the duration of the intake. It was still about an hour, whether it was standard or infused with motivational interview. Yes, sir. 5 minutes? Totally can. What worked well? This is qualitative interviews with the clinician. So using affirmations, reflections, offering choice, treatment menu, summaries, using a ruler. Those of you familiar with motivational interviewing, there's techniques where you ask folks on a scale of 1 to 10, how likely are you ever to use substances again? So that's based on a ruler. Doing two-sided statements, being non-judgmental and listening. What were some challenges? Consumers seeing little or no problem, imagine that, denying substance use. Dishonesty, consumer being in crisis, having trauma, difficulty keeping conversation going on. So a number of challenges to using the intervention. Here's some quotes. Anecdotally, it looked pretty good. When you really look at this model, DDMI, I think it's pretty remarkable. It's hard to put into words, but just the response of engagement we get from folks, how they feel connected to me, and they call me more, and they reach out more before it gets to crisis. Okay, so this is just anecdotal, qualitative stuff. I really feel like it seems to make me have a better rapport with folks. Feels like people are more able to engage for the most part. I think people feel supported and listened to, and I feel like it really works with people and helps people consider change in a different way. Now, this is an N of 1. So just keep that in context. All right, so screening results. We screened over 200 folks, as I said, declined. We had 8.4% just not giving a reason, 6.4% said they didn't have time to work with the research team. We enrolled almost 25% of those folks, lots of ineligibles, just folks not showing up, canceling or rescheduling their appointment. And this is true with a probation study I have. People just don't show up. People don't care that at risk here is going back to criminal court and taking their chances there. So you have to build that in, certainly, to doing a study like this, that you're going to have to screen a heck of a lot of folks to even get a small sample size like this. So these are some characteristics. Because of some startup hiccups and problems with the block randomization, the groups aren't as even as I would like them to be. But you can see the diagnoses, bipolar disorder, depression, those came out okay. Substance use was pretty close. Age is pretty close. A little bit of difference in gender there. And then outcomes, so this is a snapshot, and so I'm not reading too much into this. The court meets monthly to establish compliance, so what I'm going to do here, in lieu of presenting just the snapshot at 3 months and a snapshot at 6 months, is the number of months that they were compliant, partially compliant, and non-compliant over those follow-up periods. So I'm not panicking just yet, but it looks like that there, you know, some trends that there is no difference between control and treatment with respect to compliance with the court at 3 months. Those differences widen a little bit at 6 months. Really no difference with criminal justice context at the bottom. So 9 month data are still coming. I'm finalizing data collection there. And then there's a bunch of standardized measures of mental health functioning, motivation for treatment, and some other things that are forthcoming as well. All right, so DDMI is feasible and acceptable. Yes, a mental health court clinician can be trained to use DDMI with high fidelity. Also, the court clinician had ongoing supervision. Again, I mentioned Worth Bolton, who's my MI expert. He met with the court clinician monthly to review tapes, to go over what worked, what didn't work, to fine-tune the delivery of MI. Also, booster sessions. One of the designs here was that the court clinician who was trained to use DDMI would follow up each month with the change plan and basically do a booster session with each of the folks in the treatment arm. Her ability to do that was really compromised because of how busy she was. She was managing three other courts at the same time. The docket, if you've ever been to a regular court or even a mental health court, is so busy with people coming in and out that she just didn't have the opportunity to do these booster sessions. So, in a follow-up study, finding a way to ensure those booster sessions happen, I think is going to be very important. Okay, RCT in a court setting is feasible. Certainly, there's evidence now that mental health court participants can be randomized. This was acceptable to the court staff. Everybody was great. Matter of fact, most of the court staff had no idea that the study was going on. So it was really done at a very low burden to them. Block random assignments, make sure the blocks are small. I was told one thing, and this happens often, is there's what you propose and then what you can actually do. I was told that the volume of folks running through this court was actually much higher than what I experienced when we started the study. So it's certainly something to be aware of. All right. Future directions. Hopefully in R01 to do a multi-site study with courts randomized rather than staff within a court randomized. This will fix a number of problems with volume of folks coming in and sample size and so forth and eliminate some of the threats to validity. And as I said, booster sessions and close supervision for making that happen. Also, I've currently got a NIDA study with Richard Van Doren at RTI to use DDMI and integrated group treatment, which is an outpatient group therapy for folks in a local jail in Wake County, which is right next to Chapel Hill. So this is ongoing. We're trying to deliver DDMI in a jail, and then that is going to motivate folks to attend the group once they're released. Also, I've got a specialty mental health probation study I presented earlier on Tuesday, I think. DDMI, among other things, is being used with probation officers in an ongoing RCT of specialty mental health probation versus standard probation. Okay, I think I'm over.
Yeah,
you're
fine.
All right.
We have time for some questions.
Jack, we'll start out with you.
So it sounds like a really interesting model, but how feasible do you think it will be to scale it up, especially as you were saying, the court clinicians,
yeah,
to make the booster sessions and they're very busy?
Yeah, so one thing that'll help there is there's a national network of motivational interviewing trainers, MINT, so most folks are familiar with that. So the idea would be to locate a MINT trainer on the ground in each court location and to work with that trainer, pay him or her on the grant to do supervision to encourage the booster sessions. Also, you know, relationships with criminal justice partners are very delicate, and I can only demand so much of them. You know, I talked a lot about trying to implement those booster sessions in the beginning, but it just was clear to me and clear to the mental health court staff that it just wasn't that feasible. So rather than compromise that relationship by pushing it, I had to back off. But that would be one, that's a good question, and that'll be certainly something I'll need to address in an application. But relying on that network of MINT trainers would be one strategy to do that. Yes? Oh, yeah.
But she has in a rural county out in Oregon. So I know a little bit about it, but I don't know quite as much about it as I think. So I guess I have a question and then a couple of follow-up questions.
Okay.
Depending on your answer.
All right.
I guess who is representing these defendants in terms of, like, the police?
Yeah.
Yeah,
locally it's just the public defender. Yeah.
And then, that's what I assume. So my follow-up question is, like, what, I guess, is, I know a lot of public defender's offices are, like, really overburdened and overbooked. So
yeah.
Is there any incentive for the public defenders to actually utilize and encourage their their client to utilize them and make it as close to life as we can.
That's a great question. To follow up a little bit further on my answer before about public defenders, I think in one case someone had a private attorney, but basically it was public. So this is a smaller jurisdiction with not nearly the volume of, you know, certainly large urban areas. So the public defenders are really, matter of fact, the whole legal, local legal team is really bought into this model. So this has really been entrenched. So public defenders, they don't discern well with respect to severe and persistent mental illness. So they probably over-refer, but they also recognize it as an opportunity to get folks plugged into treatment. So that's kind of the incentive. Now, it's a voluntary court, and not everybody wants to do it. As I said in the beginning, sometimes the treatment sentence is longer than your criminal justice sentence. So if a defendant in particular is facing prison time, or this might be their third strike on some charge, there is lots of discussion around the benefits of doing this. So, yeah. You're welcome. Good question. Yes?
I have a question about the chronicity.
Yeah.
Enrolling some of the participants.
Yeah.
Do you look at how dated they are with the participants? I'm wondering if you're working with a certain population, more encounter the system, the less the tendency
to stay out of the system. Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, we do have criminal justice history, so we know charges and number of times they've been on probation through the court. There are some frequent flyers here. The court will take folks over and over again. Haven't looked at that aspect. You know, those who have a lengthier history with the justice system, are they less likely to not get engaged? I have those data, and that would be an excellent question to answer. And some folks don't mind going to jail at all. And again, the prospect of a year of treatment versus 2 or 3 weeks in jail, some folks will go with the jail time. So it's a good question. Yes, sir?
Yeah. So we have a colleague that does a lot of work with drug courts.
Yeah.
And there are specialty drug courts now that specialize in working with individuals with co-occurring disorders. The modifications to the intervention,
yeah.
Do you think that would be appropriate in those kinds of drug courts that specialize with populations with co-occurring, or do you think their structure is such that it may not work?
No, I think it's adaptable. I think it would work. The drug court locally does accept folks with mental illness as well. Yeah, some of them won't. So that's good that yours does. So I think it would fit right in to the drug court there. I mean, you might, it depends on, you might flip the stool if substance abuse is the primary problem versus mental illness.
Yeah.
But I think that's a minor. I mean, the spirit of MI would still be there, and the kind of the interaction between substance abuse, mental illness, and I think all of that is still very relevant for drug court. Yeah.
Thank you.